Now I would like to introduce our main speaker for the evening, Joe S. from Kensington.
Thanks. Joe Sigurdsson, average alcoholic. There was a guy here, Tom was the director for the central office a dozen years ago, and he used to use that line. He'd always say, "I'm Tom, I'm an average alcoholic." And, you know, that puts me in some pretty good company, because what I've experienced in Alcoholics Anonymous is some of the most passionate, creative, brightest, craziest, funnest group of folks ever. So I am privileged and honored to be here tonight, and privileged and honored to be an average alcoholic. Thanks, Randy, for the phone call. Did you call me yesterday, Randy? Yeah. Thanks. That's why. There you are. Yeah, I'm thrilled to be here, and I'm thrilled about this meeting. I've been here a half dozen times, you know, it's this meeting is another miracle in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, some committed folks saw the need and they filled the void, and we're all here. You know, and that miracle, you know, started 70 years ago when some committed folks saw a need, and we're all here because of them. And you know, Margaret Mead said that never underestimate the power of a group of committed people changing the world, because it's the only thing that has. And so I'm really thrilled to be a part of this and a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to send out a prayer to my friend Jimmy, who is scheduled to be here. It's an interesting story that I'm here and Jimmy's not. Jimmy's mother lived behind me when I was still drinking and using and just a madman. I was a young 20-year-old father, going nutty, and I would hear this guy working on this house behind us, and he had these, and I thought they were like Christian tapes, you know. I was hearing these, you know, like preachers, and you know, and I'd say, "Oh man, this guy, this is the Jesus freak back here working on this house," you know. And then, you know, Jimmy, I don't know if you know Jimmy, but when he talks, he's kind of got this kind of high, squeaky, kind of annoying voice. And he was always so friendly. "Hi, Joe, how you doing?" Anyway, so what's interesting is that, you know, I'd hear Jimmy working back there, and I'd hear these tapes, and now I'm going to be one of those tapes. So that's full circle for me. Yeah. So, like Jody, you know, average, you know, really solid family, great parents, lots of love. Really, no excuse for this horrible behavior that I participated in. But I did have some role modeling from them. You know, I mean, definitely my folks, they were drinkers. They were definitely drinkers. And I grew up in the 60s, and my dad was a professor at USC, and he did a lot of entertaining. And, man, these guys made it look good. My dad had, like, hardware. He had, like, this leather-bound case that opened up, and it was, like, lined with velvet, and it had a martini shaker, and it had the little, and then another compartment for the pour, and then he had these, you know, these, like, sterling silver, what are those, tumblers, yeah, and he had his, it was brown leather and gold inlay, HRS, he had his, oh, man, it was, drinking looked good, and it was important, and it was sophisticated, you know, and cigarettes too, you know. I mean, I remember my mom had this like English bone china, these little things with the parliaments stuck in them, you know, and they were out like candy, you know? And so, you know, this, you know, I'm like 6 years old going, and everyone's wearing suits and ties and talking about important stuff, you know, because they were, my dad was a sociology professor, and, you know how those guys can be. A little self-importance in the room, and I watched that for a long time, and I said, man, I can't wait, and it looked good, and so, but I never drank in high school. I mean, it wasn't important to me to drink when I was in high school. I fancied myself an athlete, and I was taking care of myself, and it was just not a big deal. And I used to really judge, you know, I'd hear kids on Monday morning about how thrashed they got over the weekend, and I didn't get it. I thought, God, why would you do that to yourself? You know, I got out of high school and I fell in love with my wife, and she's 4 years older than me, and she had a 2-year-old child, and so I graduated from high school in June, and by December I had moved in with the woman of my dreams, and I was raising a child, and I needed a job. And I got a job out in Santee, California, running a printing press at night. And I was the youngest guy on the crew. I turned 19. I was 19 years old, and everybody was at least, you know, 6, 8, 10 years older than me. And they were journeymen. You know, they were solid, hardworking guys. And every lunch at 8 o'clock, they drank. That's what they did. And, I was scared. I was insecure. I was in way over my head in life. I didn't know how to do it. I thought I was going to go to college and, you know, be a public defender. You know, I thought I really... I didn't plan on falling in love, but I did, and that's what happened. And I was working nights, and I was working with these guys, and I wanted to fit in. So after about a year, I had an opportunity to fit in. Nancy Darling was on her way up to her mother's for the weekend, and the fellows were going to go out drinking after work, and I was invited. Now, I wasn't 21, but, you know, I was a big kid and could pull it off. And so I went drinking with these guys after work. And I liked it. What happened was I had a few beers, and then I started doing tricks. I was really strong. So I would do these, like, feats of strength. And I started arm wrestling and winning money, and then I remember I told some of you guys, I said, hey, I'm going to go pick that chick up, watch this. And they're going, Joe, come on, no, you don't think I can pick her up? I'm going to pick her up. And so I walked up to this young woman, and I said, are you a co-ed? And she said, yes, I am. And I said, well, would you mind if I picked you up? And she said, no, I wouldn't. And I grabbed her bar stool, and I put her up over my head, and I put her down, and I said, thank you. And everybody said, oh, Joe, yes. So I was very clever, as you can see. I have one more piece of information. Terry took me to Andy's Saloon when I was 20 years old. For my first drinking episode. So thank you, Terry. Yeah, in fact, my whole drinking, there's a lot of my drinking career is in this room here tonight. And a lot of my sobriety. My whole sobriety. There's my favorite people in the world are in this room for what I've learned and some great teachers in my life. Okay, so So we moved the party back. We went to another drunk who's in this program. We went back to his apartment, and you know, the tricks kept going in there. This guy had a pool. He was in an apartment, and there was a balcony, and then the balcony, there was a stairway, and then there was a pool. And I said, you know what? I bet I can hit the pool from here. And they're going, no, that is okay, Joe. No, we, I'm sure you can. I said, no, watch this. You know, and so, you know, I was really drunk. I hadn't started throwing up yet, but I was getting close. But, and I jumped off this balcony over the sidewalk and hit the pool. And then I felt like a hero. I felt like, man, everybody loves me, because I was getting back slapped, and it was like, oh, great, man, I've arrived. This is what was missing. I am a part of these guys now. I can hang. I can be a part of their lives. We can drink before work. You know, we don't just have to drink after. I started drinking at 8 o'clock. I was right there with them. You know, and alcohol became a big part of the whole second shift, swing shift lifestyle. And that's what we did. We drank, and we had each other. Because, you know, my kids were in school, my wife was at work, and so were theirs. And so, you know, we went to the beach and drank before work, and we went to work, and we drank after work. And the drinking led to other outside issues, which really escalated the pace of my disease. And, you know, I started, you know, smoking some dope, and then that led to some coke and some crystal, and things got elevated really quick, and I couldn't afford all that, so I had to start dealing. It was seemed to be the legitimate. There was a huge market where I was working anyway, so it was it was not a tough sell, and then that led to more dangerous stuff and dangerous places, and you know, I was running stuff back and forth to L.A. and flipping pounds and in these horrible places where nobody spoke English and people had guns. And I was going, you know, it was getting dangerous. I was a collection agent for a coke dealer, and those situations got just horrific. The most scary ones were when they said, okay, you stay in the car. Because then I really didn't know what was happening. And then I'd sit in the car and I'd hear helicopters and I'd think, oh, this is it. I'm dead. I'm done. And so, I mean, this was not a lot of time, folks. This was, you know, a matter of like 2 years where I went from this, you know, drinking good old boy to this criminal committing felonies every day. And it got me to the bottom fast. And I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for that because I showed up to Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 28 years old. And my first meeting was Battery Chargers. And there are people in this room that were at that first meeting. And, you know, I started trudging the road to happy destiny. And but it didn't come easy and it didn't come quickly. Because I thought it was kind of a miracle that I wasn't drinking, you know, a case of beer a day and smoking an ounce or, doing an 8-ball of crystal a week. And I was smoking an ounce of weed a week. I was, like, way out of control. And that all that got down to, you know, maybe, you know, a joint a day. So I did a marijuana maintenance for about 2 years. And, you know, I kept claiming spiritual progress instead of spiritual perfection. And I came to meetings, but I didn't get a sponsor, and, you know, I didn't read the book, and, you know, I just, you know, fake it till you make it. I mean, I was not just faking it. I mean, I was a phony, and I'd show up, and really, you know, I just thought it was great. It was great that I wasn't doing all that other horrible stuff. That was the miracle for me, and actually, I kind of did get a sponsor, but, you know, I had a failing business at the time, and I thought I needed, like, somebody that could help me. So this guy I knew, he was a marketing director for a,
some company, and I thought, well, this guy's going to be able to like show me how to save my company. So I chose him to be a sponsor. And mostly I just wanted to know what to do with my printing company so I wouldn't have to go bankrupt. And so it was quite selfish and self-serving. And I remember when I had a year of not drinking, and I said, well, I'm going to have a year. And he goes, you're smoking dope. You don't have a year. And I said, well, yeah, but I haven't had a drink in a year. And he goes, dude, I'm not giving you a token. I said, I didn't ask you to. So I had Nancy give it to me. She was pretty glad that I didn't have these like derelict criminals hanging around the house anymore. So that was progress. So then, I finally thought I should do this. I should give this a clean and sober thing a try. And I quit smoking dope, but I still didn't get a sponsor. I still wasn't doing the steps. I wasn't reading anything. I was just going to like one, maybe two meetings a week. And then Nan took the kids to Boston for a wedding, and I was alone for a week. And you know, alcoholics by themselves are in bad company, and I was in some pretty bad company. And everything just, there was no governor. There was no braking system. There was nothing to stop me. And I fell right off the edge because I had nothing. I had no spiritual foundation to my life. I had nothing. I was just this hollow shell that thought he was something because he wasn't, a criminal and doing crystal and drinking anymore. And that was, anyway, it was a con game. And so in that week, I mean, things got really bad. I mean, I got completely out of control, and I hit the wall, and that's when, I can remember thinking, this can't go on. I can't do this anymore. And that's when I threw myself into the program. I'd heard it every meeting, you got to do the steps. You got to get a sponsor. You've got to be of service. You've got to walk the walk, talk the talk, and get real and be honest and be vulnerable and so I did that. I got into a step study and I did that step study for 2 years and I had a sponsor that took me through the steps. And then I took on a commitment at the central office, answering phones every Thursday. And I was doing a big book study, and I was doing a men's group, and I was doing, like 6-7 meetings a week, and then doing a lot, and then answering phones. And my wife, God bless her, said, I remember it was our 10th wedding anniversary. Also, now I've got like nothing to stop this flood of emotion, this flood of realization, this consciousness that was coming to me, where I was like this basket case, and I was just couldn't handle what a creep I had been, and the danger I had brought to my family, to my children, to all that realization stuff that about. Exactly what was going on was overwhelming, and Nan's looking at me going, what? What is this? You were better off drinking. So on our 10th, I remember it was our 10th wedding anniversary, and we were sitting up on a hill up above Helix High School, and she said, I don't know what I can do for you. Maybe you need to find somebody to recover with, whatever that is. And that's when we went and got help, because in the book's very clear about that, we gotta, if we need outside help, go get it. And so we got a counselor. Thank you, Jody. And 12-step based counselor, and she was like the mediator. She was the one that could kind of put into lay terms or some sort of context, because I really didn't even know what it was. I was just out there flailing around figuring it out and doing what everybody told me. I didn't have an original thought, you know. I was just doing whatever anybody told me because I had become that willing. And so we got some counseling and you know we pulled it together. But you know, I still had this thing about this. This ego that said that I had to be a success and I had to be somebody and I had to be something, and I was hanging on to this printing company that was killing me, and it was killing my family, and it was killing me. And you know, I remember getting a phone call at my shop at 10 o'clock at night from a member in this program. Mr. Larry, do you care if I say that, Larry? Okay, Larry calls me. Larry calls me, I really don't know what surrender is. You know, I'm struggling, I'm trying to figure it out, but I don't know what it is. And Larry said, you know, you got to give this away. You got to give this up. You got to give this to God. You know, this is not your printing company. This is not your life. This is not about you. You know, you are a tool. You are a vehicle of God's love. You are not who you think you are, and you need to give this up. And I can remember that bolt of lightning where I hung up with Larry. And I laid on the floor and I just screamed and I asked God to take it all. Just take it all. Just all of me, Lord. I'm done with this. I can't do it. I cannot do it anymore. Not another day. And you know what? The next day I felt a lot better. And you know what? This program put me on a spiritual path. And some of the things that I had heard over and over and over at the meetings around, you know, a daily reprieve based on spiritual maintenance, I started feeling better. I started having a peace about me, you know, and I didn't care about that damn printing company. I could give a shit. Sorry about that. I said, bring them on. Bring in those flatbed trucks. Haul this stuff away. You know, repossess whatever you need. I don't care. I'm done with this. And I walked away from that. And what was interesting is when I got into that total surrender, that total willingness, where I was just, you know, a loving child of a loving God, no more, no less, just a vehicle of a tool for Him to use any way He wanted. That's when everything turned around. And this is the craziest thing, because we were renting a little house in La Mesa, and I bankrupt us, and within 6 months of surrendering all that, I bought a house, and I can remember you know, it was up on a hill in La Mesa. And it had a beautiful deck and overlooking the Cowles Mountain, and we could see the city lights like from our bedroom. And I remember laying in bed and that Talking Heads song, "This is not my beautiful house. This is not my beautiful wife. How did I get here?" And I remember going, "This is God, you know. This is God." And Nan's parents, you know, But you know what? I had become a reasonable human being. You know, I had something had happened to me. They saw something in me. They weren't willing to help us get into a house until, you know, I stopped busting into the liquor cabinet, I guess, when we'd go up there. What else do I want to talk about here? What have I got here? Oh yeah, I love this. Every time alcohol was involved, you know, it was like as crazy or as nutty or as insane as I could make it. It was almost a contest, and you know, I think a lot of us are like that. And I don't know that not drinking changes that. You know, I mean, I'll tell you, I've seen some real. Crazy stuff go down in sobriety, and I'm really grateful for that. You know, What else? How much time, John? 15 minutes?
Well, I don't have 15 minutes. But I'll tell you this. This is a program of action, not thinking. And this program is a daily reprieve based on spiritual maintenance, and that takes action. And, every one of you guys has your own program, and you have your own path to God or to your higher power. And, I didn't have any of that. That was like not even conceptually in it. I didn't have anything close to a concept of God. And what I know is that I've got a little ritual that I do every morning that starts with the third step prayer and the sixth step prayer, daily reflections. And then I got an outside source that I draw from that puts me in touch with the fact that I'm not that important, that, I'm going to die. And what am I going to do while I'm here? And, what I can tell you that I've had some great sponsors in this program, and some fantastic men that were willing to see me for who I was. They weren't interested in my backstory. They'd all been there and done everything I did, but they wanted to know what I was going to do now, and they were willing just to listen to me and accept me and admire me for who I am. And that was such a gift, because it took all the pressure off. I didn't have to perform to be okay. I could just show up and I was okay. And what I've learned in this program from working with men and from having good men is that the rest of the world needs this as well. And I've been blessed to be able to pay this thing forward to young men. I'm working with teenage boys in a program that's our credo: listen, accept, and admire. This program, this is another example of a small group of committed people being willing to change the world, because that's what's happening. And it wouldn't have been possible without AA. Wouldn't have been possible without you people. Wouldn't have been possible without a loving God and of course a loving wife, who I wish was here tonight, but her mom broke her shoulder, and she's an old woman. I don't have anything. Are there any questions? Is that good? Thank you.